This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Hey there, folks. This is Screen Watching, or it's Movies to be Buried with Screen Watching. My name is Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Simon, we'll hold off before we tell people what we're doing on the podcast this week, because it's different. First of all, you're okay. You're fine. Please give me a thumb up or a thumb down.
I'm fine and good and well and proper. Everything's sort of fallen into place this week. Had a lot of fun putting this very special episode of Screen Watching together, which we'll talk about more in a minute. But otherwise had a generally productive and quite upbeat week, which I'm very happy about, which I think leads into this podcast really well, because this is something different for us. And I think this is going to be a fairly personal sort of chitty chat about some of the films we love.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely warn people who listen to this podcast that don't care for myself and or Simon, this is not going to be a good one for you, but let's just dive in. Okay, here's what we're doing. So each week on the podcast, usually we do a short block of reviews, which goes anywhere from what we plan to be 10 to 15 minutes to blowing out to 35 to 40 minutes, depending what the movie of the week is, or TV show of the week, obviously. So we usually do the TV shows, the movie reviews, and then we do what we call an intermission, which is basically whatever random things just kind of on our mind, we'll just have a bit of a chitty chat about, and then we'll close it out with some...
Yeah, largely unchanged for 128. We've had a couple of special episodes along the way, but that's kind of been the format all along, and it works pretty well for us, I think.
Yeah, but we usually wind things out with some history and trivia and sort of nonsense. But this week, we're putting all of that aside because... frankly, I was looking at the rundown for, well, not really the rundown, but the schedule for TV shows that are dropping this week on, you know, the various streamers. And I try to focus mostly on new programs rather than returning, just generally. So, like, the biggest show this week is this thing called The After Party, which is an Apple TV Plus show. It's a anthology-ish kind of a thing where there's some sort of a murder and there's a whole bunch of comedians there and... by the end of the season, you've worked out who the killer is. It's fairly potboiler sort of a thing. But it was pretty funny the first season through. Sam Richardson's like the lead of it. Tiffany Haddish is in there as one of the leads as well. Yeah. And those two are back leading the second season with Chloe Zhao, who was in that first season with her presence really up to being sort of leading lady status in the second season. First two episodes have dropped on Apple TV Plus, and like it's fine. But, like, it's not really enough to say we definitely need to record an episode of the Screen Watching podcast to talk about The After Party. Yes. Because after that, things start getting a little bit shaky in terms of what else is around. There is The Return of Foundation, which is, again, another Apple TV Plus show. That was a sci-fi show that I just wasn't that keen on. But, again, season two, don't really want to talk about a season two. There's a new Steven Soderbergh show. Sorry, Simon, give me a moment. I'm just blitzing through it.
Apparently, there's a lot more TV than we thought there was.
Well, there's a Steven Soderbergh show, but it's had such mixed reviews that I wanted to give a look at a couple of episodes before I talked about it on the show. Next week, which is equally pretty quiet for me, I will talk about the new Steven Soderbergh show, Full Circle. But outside of that, there was just nothing else. There's a show called Survival of the Thickest, which I think is like a 4 or 5 episode Netflix rom-commy sort of a thing, which it's got no traction at all. There's a couple of Korean dramas. There's an Iraqi drama that's on Netflix this week called Devil's Advocate.
Is it Cake is back too at some point, isn't it?
That's yeah, but I tend not to do reality like unscripted if I can avoid it as well.
Is it Cake? I need to get it right. I mean, I'd eat it anyway, even if it wasn't a bronze tap, I'd still eat it.
You know what, Simon? Can I tell you something about me? And this might be getting too personal.
Yeah.
I don't like cake.
Okay, this podcast's over. I am out of here.
Yeah, fair. Look, I enjoy cheesecake, which is a type of cake, but it's not cake.
It's sort of pie-ish, really. Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of the pavlova.
Oh, yeah.
Love a pavlova.
Australia's own.
Yeah.
Out of all our New Zealand listeners.
Yeah, exactly.
It's true. And look, I've got to be honest with you. I found myself in a similar vein this week with the cinema releases. We are in a very sort of bridging period. We've got cinemas filled up with your Indiana Jones and your Mission Impossibles and a couple of really big blockbusters that are taking up the bulk of the screens. And then next week we have the launch, obviously, of the Barbieheimer phenomenon, Barbie and Oppenheimer in cinemas. So this week the distributors have kind of cleared a path for themselves. They're only the only sort of significant release this week, and I use the word significant advisedly, is Ben Kingsley apparently giving a very fine performance in a movie called Dali Land, in which he plays Salvador Dali, the Spanish surrealist painter. Still with me, kids? Yes, I know. So it's a fairly quiet week, fairly quiet week for cinema releases all around. I did have a look. Are we in the review segment yet? Should I mention what I'm going to talk about briefly?
Oh, well, I mean, well, sorry, the other thing I was going to say is in terms of actual movies as well, there is a release on streaming which might be interesting, but I kind of want to take a look at it before I dedicate any real brain space to it. There's the Bird Box spin-off film Bird Box Barcelona, which drops this weekend. And like Bird Box was a big phenomenon, but I think that was really because it was a COVID thing more than people were particularly interested in that film. And it's not like there's really that much hype
around
this.
Is Sandra Bullock back? Is she back doing the Bird Boxing?
Well, this takes place the same time as the events of the first Bird Box, but it's set in, wait for it, Simon, Barcelona.
It's right there in the title. I should have guessed. Mm. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
So no, she is otherwise occupied.
Fair enough. Keeping silent. Was that the one where they had to keep quiet?
No, I think they were keeping blind.
Oh, keeping blind. Quiet Earth was, or Quiet Place was the one where they had to keep quiet. Okay, fine. All right. So, in place of anything interesting this week, I did have a look at the Wham! Documentary on Netflix, which is a very nostalgic rose-colored glasses look at the success of Wham! Over the years. Beautifully put together. It's a terrific piece of sort of archival documentary filmmaking. Fleetingly touches on the troubles that George had with his sexuality and how he had to sort of be a pop boy pinup for teenage girls around the world when not feeling that way inclined at all. But what the documentary is really about is the massive success and the friendship between Andrew Ridgeley and George Michael. And in that regard, it tells a really lovely, terrific story that I wasn't a huge Wham! Fan. The other person who lives with me in this house, my lovely wife Fiona, was, and she thought it was a terrific sort of account of their life together. So it's apparently doing okay on the old Netflix. So if you're a big Wham! Fan, or if you just want to relive the 80s nostalgia period, which I'm always down for, then Wham! Should be worth having a look at.
Yeah, I'm kind of a bit of a generation behind Wham!, so it doesn't really quite have the same lure.
Yeah, and I was sort of, by that age, by the time Wham! Came out, I guess I was, no pun intended, I guess I was hitting the pub by then. I was doing the Spy versus Spies and the Midnight Oils and all the great Aussie pub bands of the time. My sister was really into Wham!, so yeah, not my thing either, but fun music.
Yeah. This pretty much brings us into what have you been watching. And the other thing I've just been watching other than the After Party season 2 was a small indie called Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Catchy title.
It does it ever. It just rolls right off. Yeah.
So what did you finally think? Without the bells and whistles of a big Darling Harbour premiere that I got to see, you went to your local sticky-floored multiplex with the kids throwing popcorn at you the whole time. What did you think of the film?
Well, no kids throwing popcorn, so we went and saw the movie, and it was incredibly sparse. So it was a Wednesday night, we were looking around, and there was just nobody. There was literally us, there was a couple about three rows in front, and another couple two or three rows behind. That was the entire viewing audience for it, and this was not in a small little rinky-dink cinema. This was a large suburban Westfield we were at in, like, the VMAX big screen, so we were there for it. What I realized when we left was that there was also a screening taking place in that same theater for The State of Origin, which was apparently on the same night. Who knew? Man. But anyway, so I reckon if that hadn't been on, there might have been an extra 3 to 4 people in the theater.
Sure, yes, I can.
Yeah. Look, in terms of the film, I thought it's probably it's lower tier Mission Impossible, but even then, like, lower tier is still pretty good. Like, you know, let's not sound like I'm being dismissive of it. I just don't think it's quite as good as, like, the last 3 Mission Impossibles. So if we want my Mission Impossible rankings from best to worst, and trying to do this off the top of my head, it's probably, was it Freefall? Was that the last one?
Protocol or Rogue Nation?
No, there was the other one. I'm sure it's called Protocol. Freefall.
No,
that was all beforehand. You've messed it up, Simon. It's crazy. What was that last Mission Impossible film called?
Preparation for the podcast? I didn't think so.
I did so much preparing for this podcast, Simon. You just don't even know how to really wrap your mind around it. Okay, I'm loading up.
I tend to do it as where they were set. Like the so the really good one I think was
okay. Sorry, Simon. Wait. Let me do this. I got it now. I've got a list here. Okay. So the last one, which was called Fallout.
Fallout. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So Fallout, the best of the series, I think. Okay. After that, Ghost Protocol. That was the first of like the sort of reboot sort of era of Mission Impossible.
Yep.
Okay, so Fallout, Ghost Protocol, let's squeeze Rogue Nation like down underneath that one there. Then I'd probably slide in a Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, and then I'll drop in a Mission Impossible 3 and an old school Mission Impossible, the very first film, and then obviously at the bottom of the pile, Mission Impossible 2, the one in Australia.
Yeah, I don't argue with that. I'd probably have the first one up a bit higher. I thought it still holds up, but I think, yeah, generally overall that's a pretty good list.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So it's not my favorite, but like, you know, it's quite good. I thought that there was, and look, we'll certainly see what happens in terms of part two, but a fair complaint that I've heard others make, and I don't disagree, is that Mission Impossible, I expect some actual Mission Impossible-ing where there's some sort of a heist taking place and there's more involved. And one could argue and say that the airport scene was kind of heist-like.
But this was
too much missions on the fly and not necessarily, hey, we've got a thing where we've suddenly got like four people perched up here and there's, you know, a drop that needs to take place here and we need to drop Tom Cruise into this thing in order to get this thing happening over here. None of those sort of elements were in place. So I didn't really quite feel like, you know, some of these big set pieces weren't quite there in the way that you expect it from a Mission Impossible film, but it wasn't short of big set pieces. There's an amazing end sequence on a train that I thought was pretty amazing. I did find it weird going from the Indiana Jones Dial of Destiny to Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, where almost every set piece was replicated in some way or another.
Trains are back. Indiana Jones starts.
It starts with that train going through Europe in much the same way as this one. There's people on top of the train dropping for stuff flying past them.
It's one of the oldest stunts in the business. The people have been on top of trains since silent movies.
So look, I know it's not new by any means, but like you don't really see it on cinema that much anymore. And then suddenly, two films within 2 weeks doing the same thing. And then also the streets, like a car chase scene where they're in the small, narrow streets going along, pretty much the same. But Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning felt like actual proper stunt work, whereas the Indiana Jones was all just blue screen, just nonsense. And
did you feel the difference? Did you love the submarine opening? I thought that was a classic throwback to 80s.
I expected so much more. I don't really care for submarines much.
Very exciting.
I know you love submarines, so that's...
I love the submarine movies.
Yeah. But I didn't find it particularly that thrilling or engaging. Okay. It was fine. It was an okay setup. It was like a good Cold War sort of throwback sort of a thing, but that's okay. The thing that I got stuck with the film is that so much of it, and this is what I was trying to get to, we're talking about part two, so much of it seemed like them setting up next generation of Mission Impossible films. Like that brought all these characters in who are clearly going to be part of the team going forward. And like my wife sort of said as we left that one of the things that she liked, and it was really just a way for her to, you know, start ripping into Simon Pegg a little bit, was just sort of that they are all looking sort of older and a little bit more sort of haggard whatnot. And you can see that in Simon Pegg. But suddenly you've got all these new people coming who seem very young and withered and just kind of manicured. And like they all just look incredibly handsome. Even Shea Whigham, who's suddenly probably at least Simon Pegg's age, I'm sure. But like Shea Whigham's still looking pretty good, probably looking better than I've seen him like ever in other films. Like he's looking great. But yeah, like it just really very much felt like it's just that whether Tom Cruise is handing off the franchise to these guys, it felt like everything they wanted to do with the original plan to hand off the franchise to, cinema's Hawkeye a couple of years ago, one of the many attempts to give Renner a franchise. Like first they tried giving him Mission Impossible, then they tried giving him Bourne, and neither really took.
I know.
Yeah, but it just feels like actual sort of lineage sort of handing on. And that was kind of interesting because I kind of like the idea of all these people leading a film going forward.
Yeah. All right. Mm. Well, I think it's open as we speak to pretty huge numbers in the US.
Not huge, but good. It's promising.
Yeah.
Because it's at the beginning of the weekend. So, yeah.
All right. So that's what else have you been watching this week, which kind of brings us to this very special episode. How do you want to explain this to the punters, Dan Barrett?
Okay, so very quickly, a couple of years ago, the show hit the internet, hit Apple TV called Ted Lasso. People went a little bit crazy for it. They were very enthused. The breakout star of it is this guy named Brett Goldstein, who plays Roy Kent. So he's the gruff football player. But in real life, he's actually just a really lovely guy who's really obsessed with movies. Now, I came across Brett Goldstein on a couple of podcasts promoting Ted Lasso, and I found him to be incredibly engaging. And I heard that he hosted this podcast called Films to be Buried with Brett Goldstein. And I thought, that sounds kind of interesting. I should get to that. And then a couple of months ago, I actually did get around to it. And that led to me actually being interested in watching all of Ted Lasso, which I got through and had a good time with. Oh, it's quite lovely.
I wondered why that was the kicker, because I remember you went all Ted Lasso a few months back, and I thought, okay, well, now that makes sense, because you're right. On his podcast, he is a very charming, very giggly, very fun sort of presence, and clearly well-versed in the world of movies.
Yeah, like he is a real like film lover, which is great. Yeah. I don't think he'd refer to himself as like a film academic by any means. He's not really that kind of a viewer. He just loves watching movies. And so I started listening to this podcast and I tried a couple of them and I've kind of gone through like the good bulk of the library. There's a few people I sort of skipped along the way, but there's like 200 odd episodes at this point. Like there's quite a bit to work through, but it's this really fun podcast where what he does is the pretense of it is that the person that he's interviewing has died. And so he's saying that in heaven, people love talking about movies. And so the idea is to ask a series of questions, which gets to the heart of what that person's about and what their lifelong experience has been with movies. Anyway, it's a really good setup for a podcast and it really plays quite nicely. I encourage people, check out that podcast. But
check it out.
Me, as a listener to it, I listen to all these questions. I'm like, God, I'd love to be on this podcast. I'd love to answer these questions. And with this dud week that we have, Simon, I threw it to you last week. Listen to this podcast, see what you think, and let's just rip it off shamelessly and go through these questions together. And we can do our own films to be buried with, but we're obviously not in heaven because, you know.
I hadn't heard of the podcast, and not being a Ted Lasso fan, I only had a fleeting knowledge of who Brett Goldstein was, but you put me onto it and I did listen to it, and it is a fantastic format in that they talk openly about whatever they're promoting or whatever they're in town to do for the first little bit of the podcast, similar to what we've done today with the what else have you been watching segment. And then he just throws to them that you've died and in heaven you're going to have to answer these questions about cinema and film and those that have impacted you. And as you'll see from the questions that are read out, you're right, it's not all sort of hoity academic stuff or maybe a couple are. There's a lot of stuff in there about dogs, of course. that was Dan's background noise there. So, yes, I'm very keen to get on with this. It was actually challenging for me because what I found over the years, instead of recalling the personal experience of seeing films, which is what this questionnaire we're going to answer is about, my memory has taken on a sort of where were you when type of filter, and it confuses films that mean a lot to cinema with films that mean a lot to me. Like I remember where I was and who I was with and where I saw Pulp Fiction, but that's because the impact that film had at the time and not necessarily the impact it had on me. So when I had to answer these questions, I really had to sort of put the Breakfast Clubs and put a lot of the Spielberg stuff that's ruled my life behind me and think more personal. And that was a real challenge. So I'm keen to get into the answering of it. Brought up a lot of great memories for me, actually.
Yeah. And like most of the questions, I think, you know, are very easy to answer. And there's a couple which are a little bit sort of curly, which one particularly, which is probably the one that should be the least curliest to people, I have the most difficulty with. But we'll get to that, Simon.
Let's see. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Let's get through this because I don't know this is either going to be a very quick podcast or it's going to be a four-hour podcast. Let's see how it goes. Right. Okay. So the first question he usually gives people is, what was the first film you ever saw or remember seeing?
Okay. So for me, the earliest possible memory of seeing a film on the big screen was Disney's Peter Pan at the North Ryde Drive-In. Disney was a big part of my growing up. I watched films on TV, The Sound of Music, James Mason in Journey to the Center of the Earth, The Battle of Britain on TV. They were all sort of standards in my house. But the first big screen movie was Peter Pan at the North, the sadly long departed, as are all the drive-ins here in Sydney, Peter Pan. What about you?
So this is actually kind of a bit difficult for me as a, and I think it's difficult for anyone who was born from that 1980s onwards. So to answer this question, I think it needs to be, what was the first movie you purposefully saw? Because obviously, like, there's movies on TV and, like, you know, I'm sure that people just sort of stumble across stuff that way. So maybe people had a meaningful experience of suddenly seeing their first movie, but I would suggest that on TV it doesn't really quite have that same sort of, you know, push. So it needs to be that one. But kids from the 80s onwards grew up with home video. Yep. So for me, like, I sort of had this challenge. So, like, I know what my daughter's first movie was, and that was Follow That Bird, which, you know, I mean, that's a great introduction to movies. Sure. Okay, so that happened just a couple of months ago. Okay, and, you know, I'm going to note that one. I've put it on this podcast so I can refer back to it. So I can tell her what her first movie was. Okay, and my experience was probably very similar to hers in that it was a home video experience. My earliest memories of watching movies is being at my nana's place. And my nana was the first person in the wider family to get a VCR. This was so early in that it was one of those wired remote controls.
Yeah, I remember, very much so.
Truly old school. And so it was a lot of movies that had been taped off the TV, but also we were the younger sort of set of cousins around. So, like, there were three sets of cousins from, you know, her children around. And so we were definitely at, like, the lower end of it. So what we saw were just the movies that the older cousins had taped and watched, like, at her place. So it was lots of things like The Pirate Movie and Condor Man and stuff like that. So, like, that was always around. Now, I'm told my first cinema trip was to see E.T., and I have no memory of that because apparently I was 1982, so I was 2 years old and, you know, not a clue. So I don't remember that at all, but I'm told that was the first thing I saw. But trying to actually remember what I've seen, I remember as a kid, like, we went to the drive-in a lot. But as I started thinking about the movies that I saw in the drive-in, like, and also the cinema, it seems like we started doing that when I was 9 years old in 1989, so like 8, 9 years old. Because all the movies I remember were from, like, 1989. So I remember really strong memories of seeing films like Lethal Weapon 2, Uncle Buck, Parenthood, Turner and Hooch, and, like, so many others from that year.
At the drive-in.
At the drive-in. Yep. Okay, so I firmly remember seeing them. But in terms of cinema, like, I know that I definitely saw these two films in a cinema, and I don't know which one was first. So my first cinema film was either 1989's Batman or Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. We discussed this a few weeks ago on this podcast. Sure. Okay, now, Indiana Jones came out first by about 2 or 3 months, but back then, movies used to just play in cinemas for, like, months and months and months. So it is possible that I saw Batman first and then Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, but it was probably Last Crusade, I'm guessing.
Were you party to as a real toddler of the VHS era? Were you watching the Disney stuff at home? Whereas I would have seen, like The Wonderful World of Disney was a big deal for us on Sunday night in the house. We would always watch that on Channel 9 and in the evening.
Yeah, same.
And I guess that probably led into why Peter Pan was a big deal as the first movie.
The thing for me, Simon, is that the era that I grew up with, The Wonderful World of Disney being on Sunday evenings, wasn't so much playing, like, those classic movies, but when I came on was kind of at that back end of the home video era. So they were just producing a lot of stuff. So my strong memories of that wasn't classic Disney. There was a series of TV movie continuations like The Parent Trap. So obviously it's not the Hayley Mills original Parent Trap. Instead, the memories I have is older Hayley Mills being the stepmom to three triplets, which was the Parent Trap thing. Okay. And so that's my memory of it. So it's like the same thing as yours, but, like, weirdly perverted by home video being an influence.
Wow. Okay. Good first question. Where do we go next?
Okay. So the next question on the list is, what was the film that scared you the most, and do you like being scared?
This one gave me pause because I have a fairly standard answer for this. I saw The Shining way too young. And I had a really bad seat in the cinema where I was like in the first three rows of the cinema, and I had this huge screen above me where this whole madness was unfolding. Plus, it's a story. At that point,
we should tell people you love sitting at the front of the cinema. Anytime I've gone to the movies with you, you're making a beeline straight up front, and I'll be polite about it because I hate sitting at the front of the cinema.
I do sit in the first third of the cinema. I'm not right in that stupid front row, but yes, I do like to be so that the screen takes up my whole view and there's less heads and phones in front of me. But The Shining, I was too young. I actually don't remember going with anybody. I think I sort of went and saw it by myself, which was also a mistake. I'd seen like fantasy monster movies by that point, but there was something about The Shining which, to do with the family turning on itself, the father turning on the family, sort of the breakdown of that really stable environment, which I was very privileged to have at home, to see that portrayed in such a horrific way. And this is not something that I thought of at the time, but something that I thought of, you know, over the years later. It rocked my world, The Shining, and it actually sent me, and I know I've mentioned this on the podcast previously, but it actually sent me into about 6 months of terrible sleep patterns and awful insomnia where I'd, you know, not go to sleep, end up going up and sleeping at the end of my parents' bed or just sort of to get any sort of sleep, just lying on the floor next to my dad's side of the bed, which was...
And that's before you murdered them all.
Well, yeah, of course, yeah, that led to the murdering. So I would say The Shining, and I do like being scared now, although to be legitimately scared, it's probably been a while. I like the originality of things like A Nightmare on Elm Street. I'll never forget having to walk from the aforementioned Hornsby Odeon Cinema back to my car by myself, having watched A Nightmare on Elm Street. That was quite shocking. And I used to get scared of Sesame Street. Used to do this thing with hands. The hands would stand up and they'd sort of talk to each other on the screen. They were just sort of gloves, like in hands with gloves on, talking to each other. And I remember that absolutely terrifying me. I also got very scared at the end of Close Encounters when the aliens came out of the ship. So maybe that speaks to my abduction experience, but. It was definitely The Shining that freaked me out. And yes, I do like being scared at the movies.
Yeah. Horror's not really a preferred genre of mine. Like, I've certainly seen my fair share of the films over the years, but it's not really something I actively chase. And I don't really get scared by the movies. Like, that never really happens for me. But I do remember when I was a kid, and this isn't strictly a movie, but this probably plays into that home video sort of thing. In the very early 90s, they made a TV adaptation of the Stephen King book series It, and yep. So the TV miniseries of that freaked me out as a kid. I don't know if we ever got that as a TV miniseries. From my memory, it was only ever just as part of the VHS release. It was like a home video thing, so for all intents and purposes in my mind it's a movie, but it's not. Yep. But I do remember there's something about the way that is shot so starkly. Okay, like it's not a very flashy production by any means. It's a lot of very bare, basic backgrounds with some fairly harsh lighting at times throughout it. But like that actually really resonates with me. Like that just freaked me right out. And there was something to do with the way that it's shot, but also the way that it is about this creature that goes through like sewage systems, and it's all about pipes, and pipes lead into my house. So there's a good chance that it might be on the toilet. And I do remember being a kid rationalizing it, thinking, oh, well, it's US sewage systems and not Australian, so I'm safe.
There's no clowns in my toilet.
Well, you know, I wasn't ruling that out entirely, but certainly not that clown. The only thing that I can think of is legitimately a film that kind of freaked me out a bit was the first Candyman movie. Oh, and okay. When I rewatched Candyman like about a year or so ago, I'm like watching it, seeing Virginia Madsen, and the bit that I remember just really freaking me out was her like in the projects, and she's like going through like one of these apartment buildings, and it's really shot to be like super just hyper, you know, nerve inducing. But like I was watching it going, was there like an element of racism as to why I'm so scared of this? Like was young 13 or 14 year old me just a little bit racist being scared of all these black people on screen? Maybe that's the problem. I don't know. So I had to interrogate myself a little bit, but no, I think the film is deliberately trying to be scary.
It was scary, very scary film. All right, question me up again. I'm enjoying this.
Okay. What is the film that made you cry the most, and are you a crier?
I'm definitely a crier. I've become more of a crier as an adult, and films that I once would not have even considered to be cry-worthy or cry-inducing have made me cry. I now cry in Cujo when Dean Wallace is trying to you know, she's trapped in the car with the kid. I can feel the anguish and the horror that the parent is going through. So I've cried in Cujo. I cry in Poltergeist for the same reason. That becomes very much a parents protecting their children type of film. I have gulp sobbed in the Nicole Kidman, Michael Keaton film, My Life. I gulped, sobbed at the end of Less Than Zero when Robert Downey Jr. Dies. Spoiler alert. I still gulp, sob at the scene in E.T. where they try to revive E.T. with the paddles, and there's this jump cut to Gertie, little Drew Barrymore, sort of jumping when the electricity hits E.T. and she starts crying and I start crying straight away. The film I probably most sobbed in is, I'm going to say, Whale Rider, and I'm going to explain why that is. I saw Whale Rider in New Zealand. And for those of you who know the film, it's about a little Maori girl taking on her tribal traditions and winning, I guess, from her point of view. And this all happened right at the time I had my first daughter, Madison. And it was at a point where I had all these hopes and dreams and visions of the little girl taking on the world and winning and teaching the world to see the world on her terms. So to see Wild Rider present that in such a moving and powerful way, like, really connected with me on a really deep level. In fact, when I finally met and interviewed Keisha Castle Hughes, who played the young Maori girl in Wild Rider, I found it to be a really challenging experience because her character and her performance meant so much to me. I've met much bigger stars and interviewed much bigger stars than Keisha Castle Hughes, but I really felt like I was meeting someone who had legitimately moved me and touched me in some way. So I'm going to say big gulpy cries go to Wild Rider for me.
Yeah. I met her once. She was lovely.
She's very sweet and very lovely, yeah.
Yeah. My question, this is probably going to be the most psychologically probing of mine, and basically I don't think I really want to delve into too much. Yeah.
These questions made me sort of look really deeply into films I hadn't thought of in a long time, or moments as like that moment as to why it was so impactful. So yeah, I'm keen to get into it.
So, I mean, I'd say that for, you know, my first sort of, we'll say 25 years, I was like a pretty standard sort of hardcore young guy who didn't really sort of, you know, feel emotion at all. And also the fact that my dad's side of the family is British just helps out with that. Oh, well, so it's a little bit repressing, which I think is important. But like, I never really felt like emotionally, you know, drawn into things. But, and I don't know if this is connected at all. Like, there may be something to it. I don't really quite know. But I guess maybe a profound moment in my life was where a friend of mine from uni, who was also equally a bitter, just twisted person who really sort of just showed no emotion, at least in the time period I knew her, like, she ended up dying, like, in a, you know, about like 5 years after I'd gone to uni with her. But like, since then, I kind of feel as though it just seems to have opened something up, like from beyond the grave, she's just done something to me as like one final sort of, you know, F you, Barrett. So like that kind of seems, I think that may have been the thing that started triggering me. But the thing that usually triggers me in movies is moments of generosity. Okay. Like just small moments of generosity to large ones. Like it just kind of kicks me right every time, and it just frustrates me because I'm like, oh, I know I'm being manipulated, but man, it got me. So that always gets me. But then also father-son stuff, and I believe I've got a pretty healthy relationship with my father, so I don't know what it is, but like anytime there's like a real sort of father-son moment, occasionally it's like mother-son stuff, but it's always father-son. Like, I don't know, like I just feel like I've been, you know I'm being manipulated every single time, but boy, those are my triggers. If I was going to like name a film specifically, Project Nim, which is that 2011 documentary from James Marsh. For people that don't know it, it's about the life story of a chimpanzee named Nim Chomsky. And Nim basically goes from a life where he's sort of raised by hippies initially. And it's about just, you know, he's got great moments in his life and really bad and miserable, just horribly sad experiences that he went through.
It's a wonderful film. Yeah.
It ends with him sort of experiencing one of the greatest sort of elements of freedom in his life. But boy, that movie, and I can feel my eyes welling up just thinking about Nim Chomsky right now. Yeah, like that film, like I was just an absolute mess in the cinema. I don't know if my wife saw me just sobbing up her thing, but she was very polite and didn't mention it.
Oh dear, oh dear. Yeah, the good cry. It's probably been a while since I've had a good cry, and you're right. There are moments that sneak up and make you cry, that bring on the tears. Manipulative is a really interesting word, because
all cinema manipulates. Like, it's there to try to drive emotion and engagement from you.
Yeah, that's right. And you and the listeners will know my sort of affinity with all things Spielberg, and that'll come up later in these questions too. But he's often accused of being overly sentimental and manipulative. But is he, or is he just using a filmic style that maybe can be interpreted that way? And so it's a thing that I've often sort of thought about. And when he's not being like that in films like Schindler's List, I mean, he's also still being like that. But then is it any less so than Scorsese or any other great directors who have a different filmic style? So it's a great debate to have. But yeah, I love a good cry.
Mm. What film is terrible, but you love it?
I had trouble with this question.
Fair.
I don't think it's terrible if I find something to love in it. And you know where I'm going with this. 1941 is a go-to for me.
I knew exactly where this was going.
But I've got lots of arguments as to why it's not terrible, but most people think it is terrible, but that's fine. Where I ended up finally going with this, that as a child, as a teenager, I should say, in the 90s, there are a lot of very questionable teen comedies or comedies in general of that period that haven't aged well. It was a time when the studio bosses were desperately trying to bring a younger audience into the cinemas. They realized off the back of Star Wars and Jaws that audiences were getting younger and younger. So let's go younger and younger with our sensibilities and our way of looking at life. And out of that came a whole lot of teen comedies. And these were never my favorite films, but things like The Porkies and The Police Academies and stuff like that. I'm going to go with a film.
Sorry, wait a sec. I was talking about home video. Police Academy, very big in my household as a kid.
And, I know, yes. We've discussed the impact of Police Academy on both our lives. the film I'm going to go to as being one that's terrible but that I have a very deep affection for is Bachelor Party, the Tom Hanks film.
I knew it was heading like in this direction or Just One of the Guys. It was one or the other.
I love Just One of the Guys. That's a very smart film. Bachelor Party came along. My friend Richard and I were mad on Tom Hanks in Bosom Buddies. We thought that was the funniest show on television, and we instantly were charmed by the Tom Hanks magic. So when Bachelor Party came out, it was Tom Hanks behaving in such a way that we both wanted to behave all the time, and we thought was hugely cool. And we ended up seeing it like three or four times at the movies and then countless times again on VHS, on video. I look at it now and realize that it's very much a film of its time. There's not much in the film that would get onto screens, big or small, nowadays. It has a blue streak in it that I think Hanks has largely eschewed in any sort of interviews that he gives. He doesn't want to talk about the Bachelor Party days. But yeah, it's an ostensibly terrible film that I still really have a lot of affection for.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Tom Hanks is actually pretty good about his early career. Like, he was talking about being on The Love Boat. He was talking about Bachelor Party.
Tawny Kitaen, the wonderful, beautiful Tawny Kitaen. I think she's passed away now, but she was the love interest in that. And who'll ever forget Nick the Footlong or whatever he's... Yeah, it had a whole lot of stuff in it, and of course the donkey. Anyway, let's move on. What's yours?
I've never actually seen it, but I just on Hanks, I do like that even towards like, you know, the back end of his career, like years after he got away from Bosom Buddies, you still see Peter Scolari occasionally crop up in his movies and, you know.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
They had a great chemistry together. It was such a funny show. Again, of its time, but I've tried to introduce Bosom Buddies, Bachelor Party. I tried to introduce Stripes into this household once and I got stared down. It is a very deeply offensive film to people of a certain mindset. So a lot of those 80s comedies, whereas I can see the young man I was back then and still get a big laugh out of a lot of them and the impact they had on me when I first watched them. Others experiencing it for the first time in 2022 or 2023. Not so much.
Okay, so like you, the idea that if I like it, then I can't say the movie's terrible. And also, I have troubles like referring to any movie as terrible. You know, there's movies that I don't respond to, but I don't know. A film that I really like quite a fair bit and the world has very much decided this is not a good movie and I don't understand it because I just think there's so much in it that's worthwhile. And it's not a top tier movie by any means, but I still just really liked it. The Darjeeling Limited, the Wes Anderson film.
Okay.
Yeah, people just hate that movie. Like, really just have a visceral just hatred of that film. And I don't get it. Like, I can... It seems to have followed... It was the next film he did after Royal Tenenbaums. And people love the Royal Tenenbaums. And one of my favorite movies. I've got the movie poster for it just over there. Really loved it. Actually, no, it wasn't the next film he did. The next film was The Life Aquatic, which is, again, another film that people largely do not care for and a film that I really love dearly. But yeah, like, I don't know, maybe I'm just too much of a Wes Anderson fanboy, possibly, but I don't know. Like, every time I see Darjeeling Limited, I just think it's a better and better movie than the time before.
Where do you rate it on your favorite Wes Andersons? Because I think even those that love Wes Anderson have some issues with... I saw it once at the movies and didn't care for it much. Don't have, like, a visceral hatred of it. I just thought it was one of his less convincing efforts. One of his... style, where his style overrides any substance to it, which in his better ones isn't the case. It's a perfect balance. But is it your favorite Wes?
Favorite Wes, and I just got the list up on my screen, so I'm going to try to do that. And please, well, don't hold me to this one. I'm creating a list on the fly. But I would say probably in order of favorites, haven't seen it yet, is Royal Tenenbaums right at the top. Then probably, I don't know, Rushmore and Life Aquatic really are fighting sort of neck and neck for like spot number two. I'd probably be inclined to go Life Aquatic just because I've seen it more times, but I did see a double feature of Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums during the pandemic, and boy, did I just have an amazing evening. But we'll say Royal Tenenbaums, Life Aquatic, Rushmore, and then I'm probably going to drop in a Darjeeling Limited. I think I'm right there for it. I'd drop in a Grand Budapest Hotel then, Isle of Dogs, Fantastic Mr. Fox, French Dispatch. Then I'd drop in, where are we at now? Moonrise Kingdom, which is my least favorite of his movies.
Oh, okay. See, I went the other one. That's one of the ones I thought had a bit of real heart to it, whereas some of his others don't. And I prefer his comedies. See, Rushmore to me is great. Grand Budapest Hotel is great. I love French Dispatch too.
French Dispatch, the problem with French Dispatch is that when you're watching a Wes Anderson film, it's so much about the color and vibrancy of what he's bringing to screen. But for some reason, he chose to film so much of that in black and white. And to me, like, it really just detached from, you know, what I thought was the strength of him as a filmmaker. Mm. Yeah, like, it's fine.
Well, okay.
Yeah. But I just thought I haven't seen Bottle Rocket, which I feel is a massive oversight at my end.
Yeah, it's hilarious. It's very funny. Yeah. And we're queuing up for Asteroid City, of course, which is another one which seems to have either have its passionate lovers or passionate dislikers. So.
Yeah, and that's why I'm excited by it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the films that are divisive are the ones that I like the most of his generally, Royal Tenenbaums aside.
Yeah. This is an interesting question, the next one. What is the film you once loved, but watching it recently, you realize it's quite terrible? Wow.
Okay, well, I'll answer this one because you've asked the question.
You go first.
I generally find that I can't really answer this question so cleanly. I'm able to do this more with TV than movies because TV, I think, is more reactive to the culture and has that connection to zeitgeist sort of aspects. So I just kind of feel that it's easier for a TV series to suddenly feel completely out of step with what we're after from something than movies do, which there's always a reason why you're willing to excuse something for being quote-unquote terrible if you want to really think about it sort of closely. So a TV show I would say is outrightly terrible that I once loved was the show Buffy, which I tried watching that again the last year or two, and it is just unwatchable shit. But if I'm pushed to come up with a movie, I'd say a film that I loved as a kid that I absolutely think is absolutely abhorrent these days is The Adventures of Milo and Otis. And not so much for the content seen on screen as much as the shocking animal abuse that took place off.
Yeah. All the stories behind that appear to paint the filmmakers in a rather unflattering light.
Unflattering? Murderous light. There are multiple Milos. There are multiple Otises. And none of them are good stories.
Yeah. Sure, can't argue with that. I think I'm going to cause a little bit of a stink with mine. The film that I once loved but now realize is quite terrible is Return of the Jedi. Uh-oh. Oh, Dan's gone. This could be the end of the podcast. Dan? Let me... Oh, wow, he really has gone. Let me qualify this to the listeners. To me, it's not even the worst of the Star Wars films, is what I'm saying. But it is the one that I really loved, but now see as being where the rot set in for the Star Wars universe. I jokingly refer to it sometimes as the Star Wars Muppet movie because it was overtaken by Lucas's sort of passion for the Muppets and love. He sort of pulled it off in with Yoda in Empire Strikes Back, and then he went all Muppety in Return of the Jedi, which still works to a certain extent, and things like Jabba and some of the creations in Jabba's palace there are pretty incredible. The other thing that the reason it has a bit of a stink about it for me is that when I was in high school, it was still a few weeks from being released, and my friend brought home a pirated VHS tape of it. It was terrible quality. I could barely watch it. From what I remember of the story...
Was this one of the first pirated films you saw?
Yeah, it was. It was the first.
The first pirated film I saw was a little film called The Phantom Menace.
No, we're bringing the Lucasfilm Empire down one film at a time. I remember vaguely, and I don't know if this story was true, but it had been taped many times over, and you could tell that it was a terrible sort of scratchy white noise copy. But it had been passed around one of the major prisons here in Sydney and had done the rounds as some illegal booty inside Parramatta Jail or one of the big prisons. And
I stopped paying attention. Are we talking about a movie here or you?
No, definitely a movie.
Okay.
Well, mine came much later after this.
Yeah, sure.
And it just had this icky, sticky, sort of horrible...
Again, are we talking about the movie or... Sorry, go on.
So it always had a little bit of a dark spot in my mind that I broke the law by watching it, and I gave into this curiosity that I knew was illegal and I shouldn't have ever done that. And then I started to watch the film, and it's I can't go back and watch it now. I think it's a shoddy piece of work. Despite some fantastic effects there on screen, I think the trap and all that sort of stuff is just stupid. So sorry, everyone. I am a Star Wars, huge fan of Star Wars, as you know. But Jedi
Except you rarely ever watch any of the new ones, and you just seem to hate all the old ones.
I could live without any of the films between Empire Strikes Back and Rogue One. They're the two best in the series. And I know how you feel about Rogue One, but I think it's a great film.
See, here's the thing with Rogue One, and I've got some serious issues with that. I'm going to be curious watching that in context of having watched Andor. So yeah. I'm kind of curious to see if my estimation of Rogue One increases once I watch that off the back of season 2 of Andor.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, or maybe I'll still just hate it.
Should Andor have got more Emmy nominations this week?
Yeah, I don't know if it actually could have. Like, it did pretty well. It's like about 11 nominations off the top of my head.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. That's interesting. What's the next question?
Next question is, what is the film that means the most to you, not because of the film itself, but because of the memories you have of it?
The year was, I would say, late 1979, and I am just starting to soak up everything movies. It's it's taking shape as my major obsession. To their credit, my parents totally recognize this, totally lean into it. Over a period of about 6 months, 8 months, I guess, they took me to see all the Oscar nominees that year that I was able to see. That was the year that Apocalypse Now came out. It was rated R and I couldn't see that. But they took me to see Kramer versus Kramer. They took me to see Al Pacino in And Justice for All, Paul Newman in Absence of Malice, Sally Field in Norma Rae. So I got to see all these really formative sort of late 70s Hollywood films on the big screen with my parents, and then discuss with my parents afterwards what I liked about it, what I didn't like about it. The most challenging of those, and one session that I saw with my parents that I'll never ever forget, was
1941.
I never saw that at the movies. They wouldn't take me to the movies to see that, especially Bob Fosse's All That Jazz with Roy Scheider. It's a semi-autobiographical film that Bob Fosse told about his life when he had the heart attack, how his marriage fell apart. And you got to understand, this is a 1979 film, so young Simon's maybe 12 or 13 years of age. And it's some of, you know, coming out of that movie led to some of sort of the deepest, most adult conversations that I first had with my parents, in and their interpretation of the film and how it informed my love of cinema going forward. So there are other ones that obviously pop up in thinking of this. To be honest, there's about a dozen different answers for all of the questions in this for someone whose whole life has been filmed like me. But I'm going to say All That Jazz is the film that means the most to me for that reason.
Yeah, the film that I think probably opened the door to the most sort of open adult conversations I've had with my parents is also a 1979 movie, The Muppet Movie.
Really? Well, you, how old were you? You would have been like 3 years old when it came out.
I wasn't born in 1979. sorry, I did open up a list of like 1979 movies, and the couple that Google threw at me very quickly was like, there's some great stuff in 1979.
It was a huge year.
Putting aside the original cut of Superman 2, you've got Alien, you've got Apocalypse Now. What else? The Jerk. What else have we got here that jumped out at me? Mad Max, Time After Time, which I think is an all right classic.
Yep.
What have we got here? There was something else that really sort of, obviously the Muppet Movie. Yeah. We should do a couple of like year-based themed episodes. We'll get to that.
I could go on forever. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, sorry. The film that meant most to me. I don't know. I sort of struggle with this one because I don't know, like there's like films that I've seen that I've had like really sort of strong reactions to for one reason or another, but they're not necessarily like moments in my life that were particularly amazing. And there's a couple of movies that have been sullied by just, you know, a bad date that I was on or something. Like I can't watch any of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies purely because of the girl that I went and saw the first one with. But this is maybe the sort of counter version of that one. The film I'm probably going to list is State and Maine. And first of all, I love that movie, so that takes things a long way. But also, the way that I saw it was that I just started seeing this girl. We were supposed to like spend Saturday hanging out, but she got called into work. So I was like, maybe it wasn't even a Saturday. It was, you know, I was at uni, so it was, you know, could have been any day of the week for all I know. It was all a Saturday. Based on like, oh, well, I've got like 5 hours until she finishes her shift. I've got to go and do something. I'll go and see a movie. First time I saw a movie by myself.
Wow.
Yeah.
Independent man.
Yeah. And it turned out to just be a really great film that, you know, I love dearly. And so like, it was just this lovely little moment. But also, and this is weirdly connected, while seeing that same girl, there was a Saturday night. I just remember there was just this weird thing that seems to happen where on Saturday nights, I just sort of find myself watching TV, like her bedroom TV, just sort of late at night. And The Spanish Prisoner came up, another David Mamet film. Had this really sort of strong memory of watching it. And it was purely because it was a film I'd never heard of before. I didn't know anything about The Spanish Prisoner existing as a movie. And it probably came just a few months after seeing State and Maine as well. Okay, but like I just found myself connecting with this film sort of in the darkness while she was asleep in the bed near me and I was just watching this amazing film.
First time you hear, and I had a similar experience with House of Games, which is another David Mamet film, and of course,
which I haven't seen. It's the only Mamet I haven't seen.
And of course, Glengarry Glen Ross. When you first hear Mamet's dialogue.
Sorry, which I can't think of Glengarry Glen Ross without thinking about the Late Show parody, Glengarry Glen Ridge.
But the point is that when you first hear Mamet's dialogue, and I've seen a couple of his plays on stage, but it's mostly been in the movies that I've seen his work.
Yeah,
he did an amazing film with Val Kilmer called
Spartan,
which is a terrific piece of writing.
You know what? Having watched it recently, I'm not sure amazing is necessarily the word for it, but I really quite like it.
Yeah, I like it as well.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Did you ever see Red Belt?
Red Belt?
Yeah. That was the David Mamet film he made after he started getting into martial arts much later in life.
I did not see Red Belt.
Oh, it stars, what's his name? Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Chiwetel?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
It's like, it's one of the last Mamet films. Check it out. Like, it's a good film with a few surprising actors that crop up throughout it.
All right, okay. Red yeah. Belt, Love Mammoth. Okay, that's good. Mm. What is the sexiest film, Dan Barrett? I'm keen to hear where your dirty little mind goes with this question. What is the sexiest film?
Here's the thing. And I mean, I've watched a lot of movies with sexy content in it, but like, I don't know, I don't really find a lot of stuff on screen to be particularly that sexy. Like, I just found this a bit hard to really answer. I don't know if that's an unfortunate pun or not. Oh,
terrible pun.
It wasn't intended. if I'm going to name anything, it's probably the opening minutes of the movie Laurel Canyon, which I don't know if you remember that film, but it's got an opening sequence. Do you remember the film at all?
Sort of.
It's like Lisa, what's her surname? Like Chokio?
Cholodenko, yeah.
Cholodenko, yeah, there we go. The film, it opens with Christian Bale in an intimate sort of scene with Kate Beckinsale, and he goes down on her, and that always just sort of stuck out at me purely because you don't really see that in movies very often, like in major films. Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
Anyway, a film that I really quite liked at the time, then I tried watching it another time and realized that the band that was supposedly this amazing band that everyone was really obsessed with were really no better than like Matchbox 20. And I was just like, ugh, come on. If the music
the
was better, that film.
Of all beds.
Yeah, exactly. If the music in that film was better, I think it'd be a much better received and better remembered film.
All right. Well, my age gives me an advantage here, because when I'm asked what the sexiest film is, it just becomes a memory potpourri of 80s Michelle Pfeiffer. So I would just, without even batting an eyelid, I would rattle off Lady Hawk, Into the Night, Witches of Eastwick, Married to the Mob, Tequila Sunrise, all of which culminates in The Fabulous Baker Boys. 80s Michelle Pfeiffer continues to have a hold on me. My phone photo, my lock screen on my photo is Michelle Pfeiffer from Into the Night. So she remains, and my wife won't mind me saying this, but she remains my hall pass. She's still the most beautiful woman to ever step in front of a camera.
Sorry, did Fiona agree to her being the hall pass, or you just sort of laid down the law saying, sorry, hall pass?
I've just got it scribbled on the front door that if Michelle comes a knocking, just come and get me. I would also see, I mean, and like you, it's hard to sort of define this because you can see sexy people on screen, like Natasha Kinski in Cat People, I remember just rocked my world, just filled up my high school diary at the time. And I recall being just totally won over by that. In fact, a very quick, funny story. There used to be this huge big format magazine called The Video Age, which was sort of, was kind of a trade publication for the home video industry, but was also sold in news agents and stuff. And Graham Kennedy, the late great Graham Kennedy, used to have a letters page on there, and he would invite readers to write in their written reviews. They'd have the reader's review segment, which would be a little box at the top of this big sort of A5 size page. And I wrote one in for Cat People and saying it's quite good and I didn't love the film. And then I ended with, of course, Natasha Kinski is naked most of the time, so I was quite distracted by that. And he wrote a little thing saying, Mr. Foster, as a future film reviewer, you should not be distracted by naked people on screen, although it is Natasha Kinski, so we'll let this one go. And I've still got that somewhere hidden away in here. It was my first published review of Natasha Kinski in Cat People. But yes, Lady Hawk, Pfeiffer, very sexy film opposite Rutger Hauer and Matthew Broderick, and Leo McKern, the very sexy Leo McKern. Fabulous Baker Boys too. So they're my sexiest films.
Yeah. Okay.
Sex itself isn't, it's like watching sex itself isn't that sexy on screen.
No.
There's some, the other film that that comes to mind is Blue is the Warmest Color, the French film from a few years ago with Léa Seydoux and Adèle Exarchopoulos, who played two lesbian lovers who have this amazing chemistry and amazing passion on screen.
And the least charismatic scene in the entire film is the one that goes for like 8 minutes.
Exactly right. But, it was their chemistry and their passion and their fire for each other that made that a very sexy film, not necessarily the very fleshy sort of bits that we got to see in the movie. So that's certainly one I'd put up there. But sex itself, you know, it doesn't need to be in a lot of films. You know what goes on. They could imply it, but anyway.
I have very strong memories of watching Blue is the Warmest Color in Palace, barracks in Brisbane, next to noted Brisbane film critics Sarah Ward and Matthew Toomey. And boy, that was like an awkward bunch of minutes.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
I know Matthew, he's a good guy.
Maybe I should have seen that one alone.
Okay. Now this one is going to be a tough question. What's a film that isn't supposed to be sexy, but you found yourself turned on by? This is a very awkward part of the podcast, Dan, but dozens of people will be switching off about now, but I'm keen to hear what you found sexy, or no, what you weren't supposed to find sexy, but you did find yourself turned on by.
What I find funny is that you ignored the funniest part of the question, and this is...
Well, I'm not
this
quite sure what the... I'm quite sure what the second part of that is.
Well, this is the thing. This is the name of this part of the section. Okay. So Brett Goldstein in his podcast, this question is basically, what's the film that's supposed to be sexy, but you find yourself, but it's not supposed to be sexy, but you find yourself turned on by, AKA Troubling Burners or Worrying Wide-Ons, which I just think is the funniest thing.
Wide-on. Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Now I know what a Worrying Wide-on is. That's right. We're going to have to put a little E next to this podcast on the Apple page.
Kids got a loan. Okay, we'll just drop it out there. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Anyway. All right. Well, where do we go with this? What are you going
to
say?
Oh, look, I mean, very easily, this is not a difficult question for me to answer at all. Okay. I mean, maybe it should be. The thing that I feel is it's supposed to be sex. Oh, sorry. Actually, wait a sec. Sorry, I just realized I've approached this from the wrong direction entirely. Because I think that this is supposed to be sexy. Okay, but I'm trying to think. I feel that the way that this has been written on the page here is actually different to the way it's presented in the podcast.
It's or a maybe tough not. One to I don't know.
But basically, what I was going to talk about was the sex scene in Pump Up the Volume. So that movie isn't particularly a sexy movie, okay? But there is a sex scene that's in the middle of it. And the thing is, at one point, it was completely appropriate that I'd find it to be, you know, an intriguing scene. Okay, because you've got a very topless Samantha Mathis in it. But as years have gone on, with me occasionally watching that film again, okay, I find it difficult watching it because she's very much a high schooler in that film. And so at one point it was age appropriate for me to be able to watch that and go, okay. But now it's slightly awkward. But
you
also
cross over into that dirty old man territory.
Yeah, but as you're watching it, but the thing with like a dirty old man is that you're watching current material and being dirty about it, whereas for me it's very much I'm still feeling that same sort of vibe of watching it and connecting to it as a younger person. Okay. And so I've brought that with me through time.
Yep.
But it's still awful.
I get it.
Yeah,
I bet it is. Okay, I'm gonna I immediately thought of the conversation that we had about Shiver Baby a couple of years ago.
Okay.
Which was the film Rachel Sennett, I think was her name, the young actress in it, in which she goes to the Jewish funeral ceremony. She has same-sex feelings for Diana Agron, I think was the other actress in the cast. I'm trying to remember back. But we spoke at the time of it being a really intimate, quite a sexy, very funny movie that had us feeling those sort of urges that she was feeling at the time, and the film I think very successfully conveys those even to two old middle class white guys like us.
But what's clever about that movie is because it does have that intimacy going on, but as that film happens, and this isn't really to build intimacy, it's to build stress and frustration for her, is that every, like, you begin that movie with a whole bunch of really wide shots, and then as the film keeps on progressing through and she feels more and more boxed in by her family and relationships and other people that are attending this Shiver Wake, the scenes, like the actual structure of the shots and the composition of the shots keeps on getting smaller and smaller to the point where the final scene is like her crammed into a very small car with her family being like shoved on each side as well. And so the spaces keep on getting smaller, but the camera shot just keeps getting tighter and tighter. So that probably builds that intimacy, even though it was supposed to really be about the stress that's building.
The other film I'd mention very quickly is probably the two most beautiful sexually energized stars of early 80s cinema.
Milo and Otis.
Deborah Winger. Milo and Otis, the late great. Deborah Winger and Richard Gere together in An Officer and a Gentleman. Now, there's a couple of very sort of torrid sex scenes in that film, but it's the scenes where they're falling in love and sort of, and eyeing each other up over drinks at the bar and getting to know each other, which make that an intensely sort of sexy film, and scenes that aren't meant to be ones that turn you on and ultimately do. So I thought An Officer and a Gentleman had a lot of heat to it.
Yeah. Okay. Simon, what is the film that you most relate to?
This is something that we've mentioned in the podcast. The role as sort of, for want of a better phrase, purveyors of truth or gladiators for truth that journalists play. So All the President's Men is something that I, if not relate to, then maybe aspire to, the integrity of these two journalists and what they did to bring down Nixon's government and reveal the Watergate side of things. I'm putting a lot of pressure on myself there to be the next Woodward and Bernstein, but it's probably not going to happen at this stage. But I relate to the integrity. I relate to the passion that they brought to bringing the truth out. And to that extent, so also Warren Beatty's Reds about John, what's his name, who was at the forefront of establishing the Communist Party, a journalist who established the Communist Party in America. So they're the two films about journalists that I sort of look to as being aspirational and that I can relate to.
Yeah, I found this is the one that I actually really had trouble coming up with an answer for, because relating to a film is quite different to relating to a character from a movie or a character's journey from a film, because there's plenty of characters I feel I can relate to, but I don't know about an actual movie itself. But I guess maybe if I'm pushed into answering something here, I guess maybe the movie Office Space, which I think is a very relatable movie for so many of us that spend time in offices.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I just like that constant sort of pressure of an office environment. But also, I mean, I kind of feel that I relate to that Ron Livingston character a fair bit through it, and just some of the general frustrations.
Oh, see, that's interesting. Now, you know, you've made me think of Jerry Maguire, which came along at a time when...
You were a sports agent.
I was this sort of hotshot young sales rep and looked to for success and to hit all my sales targets, but didn't really enjoy my job at all and wanted to get out and do better things. So that movie, I instantly related to that character and that movie in that moment. I probably wouldn't so much now, although I still really love the film. But yeah, I actually just thought of that one. That's another good one.
Mm. Which film is objectively the greatest ever?
Okay, objectively means that the film critic and the film historian me has to kick in. If it was subjectively, I'd run off on a tangent. But objectively...
Well, look, I should point out that this question comes from a comedy podcast. And so when he's asking it for us to be objectively the greatest ever, I think that ultimately what he's really asking is subjectively, what is the greatest movie ever? But anyway,
You're probably right. I'm going to, like, from the point of view of the film that influenced the filmmakers that influenced me, I've got to say Lawrence of Arabia. Mm. It influenced Spielberg and Scorsese and George Lucas and all those 70s era movie brats that came along. They all cite Lawrence of Arabia as being the epic sort of mix of old school Hollywood and new vision and new filmmaking format. So this is part of a standard answer I have when people say, oh, you're a film critic, what's your favorite film? So I always sort of rattle off, there's films that I now understand to be landmark films for their use of, the way they changed the art form or new craftsmanship, things like Citizen Kane and 2001, A Space Odyssey. I get why they are now considered like asterisk points in the history of film. They change the game for everybody. So, I think for me, the objectively the greatest film ever, certainly for my generation, is Lawrence of Arabia.
So the wording of this question I really love, because every time they like question the wording of it within the original Films Be Buried With podcast, everyone focuses on the word objectively and the idea of it being subjective or objective. Okay. But to me, the key word in this question is actually the word greatest. Okay, if the question was, what is objectively the best movie ever made? Like, I could tell you that without hesitation, it's probably the movie The Third Man. Okay, I just think that is the best movie of all time. But it's the greatest movie and not the best. So therefore, it shouldn't necessarily be a film that we're judging on technical capability or artistic merit, but instead it's just like, that is a great movie. It becomes more guttural. And it's just like, what are you reacting to? So...
Yes.
With that in mind, I think the answer might be The Untouchables, which is both my favorite movie of all time and the movie I just think is the greatest movie of all time. Again, Dave Mamet writing the script.
Yeah, full circle.
Yeah, you can see who really factors quite heavily into my film passions. But yeah, The Untouchables, like, I just have such a great reaction to that movie because, one, it's strong filmmaking throughout it. Artistically, I don't know it's necessarily that strong, but it's not without artistic merit. Like, I think it's got a really cracking script. Yeah. I think there's, you know, performances that are really interesting. There's a lot of filmmaking technique that's kind of really fascinating.
You were De Palma.
I mean, it's De Palma, like, right near the peak of his powers. Like, it was definitely probably the end of De Palma being good. But, you know, ultimately, you've still got good De Palma there. I think it may be the greatest movie of all time.
I can't argue with that, and that's going to come up in the next question for me. One of the films I've watched the most, The Untouchables, is almost a perfect film in my regard. I can't argue with that. Gee, if I had to answer the greatest film ever, The Guttural, Untouchables would be up there. Maybe Die Hard. Maybe. Yeah. See, now we're getting into that sort of standard ones that where I just remember how much they hit me when I first saw them. So this is where I start rattling off the Close Encounters and the Die Hards and those sort of things. So, yeah, interesting. All right. So I've touched on the next question. Which film is the one you've watched the most?
For me, and I came very close to saying this is the greatest film of all time, but this is, again, if we're thinking about it purely in guttural sort of love, Point Break.
Oh, what? Really? That's the film you've watched the most?
I've watched that film so many times in so many positions and scenarios, and I can't get enough of that movie. But if you're going to ask me the film that I saw the most in the cinema, one, Point Break would be up there because I've seen it a few times in the cinema now, okay? But originally at the drive-in, just as a point of note. The film I saw in the cinema probably the most was Gladiator. So it came out at a time when I was at uni, and so I had a bit of extra freedom to go and do that sort of thing. But I reckon I went and saw that picture at the cinema at least 2 to 3 times a week during its like an original run.
Wow, okay.
I've seen that film so many times.
That's interesting. What have I seen? I mean, my initial reaction to this was something of Spielberg. So it'd be Raiders, or it'd be Close Encounters, or maybe Poltergeist, which, like I've mentioned before, is one of my favorite films. And then my generation, it's always Star Wars or The Breakfast Club or Ghostbusters. At the cinema, though, I saw Aliens 7 times. I saw The Fly 7 times. I saw Jurassic Park 6 times at the cinema. So these are all ones that I went back for. The film that I've probably watched most than any other one is a Walter Hill rock and roll fable, it was called itself, called Streets of Fire, with Michael Paré, Diane Lane, Rick Moranis, featuring just some of the greatest rock and roll tunes, an early performance by Willem Dafoe. If you haven't seen Streets of Fire, introduce yourself to the music first. Who was the guy that did all the music for Meatloaf? Steinberg or Stein? Oh, I can't remember his
name. Sure.
But he did, and he did Total Eclipse of the Heart for Bonnie Tyler as well. He did a lot of those big songs, which Diane Lane, at her sexiest, sings in this film. So Streets of Fire is one I go back to over and over again. Funny story, I have a T-shirt with the Streets of Fire beautiful artwork on it. I opened the door to our hotel room during a recent trip Scandinavian trip, and the young man who was bringing us towels looked at my T-shirt and he goes, "I love that music. I love that movie." He was so it traveled the world, this the love for Streets of Fire. So if you haven't seen it, do get out and see it.
And just for a point of correction in there, the hottest movie with Diane Lane is, of course, the movie Under the Tuscan Sun from 2003.
She's beautiful in that as well. Remember her in Unfaithful opposite Oliver Martinez with Richard Gere as well? That was a sexy cast.
Do I ever?
Wow.
Is it getting hot in here, Simon?
It certainly is.
What are we asking here? It was, we've moved on to what is the worst film you've ever seen?
All right. I've only got a couple of more questions to go.
Literally two.
This is where my Letterboxd account actually came into play a little bit. As a film reviewer, I'm bound to see a lot of films. Some of these I wouldn't go to. There's been 2 half-star movies in the decade that I've been on Letterboxd. One was Zoolander 2, which is putrid, and a movie which I saw on my birthday in 2014 for some fucking reason was Transformers Age of Extinction. I was having a bad birthday.
Which one's Age of Extinction? Is that the second one?
I think that was the Arthurian Knights one. No, I think it's the third one. Anyway, I hated both of those films. I've seen a lot of really bad films. I can go all the way back to the late 80s for a film called Johnny Be Good with Anthony Michael Hall, Robert Downey Jr. and Uma Thurman, sort of a college campus football comedy, which was just repugnant, a horrible, horrible movie, the worst of the 80s teen comedies. So Johnny Be Good in there. But I've seen a lot of really bad films, so it's hard for me to zing on one.
Yeah. Look, I just suddenly, I never thought to look at my Letterboxd, and there's a couple of films in there that I've given some pretty low scores to that were probably a bit unfair. Like, I just
you
really
rated
just,
angry, did you?
I really just fucking hated Babylon last year. Like, that was awful. But I don't know that it's a one-star film. I might be polite and give it 1.5 stars now. And then I watched the film Willow for the first time a couple of months ago, ready for that TV show. And the TV show is pretty good, but the movie just stinks. I gave it 0.5 star. But I don't know that's the worst movie I've ever seen. House of Gucci's probably up there. Like, that was just offensively bad.
That just got boring for me.
Yeah, but like that's the thing. And the boring is probably the question. So like, what's a boring bad movie? And like, what's actually like just a terrible, awful, just bad movie? And so the thing I came up with without looking at my Letterboxd was probably Year One. Do you remember that? That's the Harold Ramis directed movie starring Michael Cera and Jack Black, as I recall. Yeah.
Terrible film. That was one of the first films that Fee and I saw together. And we thought, oh, God.
And you're still together.
Remember us saying at the time, because sorry for treading all over your answer here, but we went and saw Knocked Up. And we laughed and laughed all the way through. That was one of the funniest movies we'd seen. And we thought, oh, let's give more comedy a go. So we went and saw Year One, and we just came out of it angry. And when she hates a movie, she gets really angry. She came out of Few Best Men, the Australian one.
Oh,
I'll never forget when she came through the door. Her cheeks were red and her eyes were white. She has a visceral reaction to really bad films. So, yeah, we hated Year One. Sorry, go on and give your side of the story.
Oh, no, I mean, that's pretty much it. Oh, I mean, I'm just amazed that you're still together. I would have thought that the two of you would just shake hands and then just, like, go off in the dark by yourselves.
Well, we figure if we see the worst film we're ever going to see that early in our relationship, it's like that scene in The World According to Garp when the plane crashes into the house. They say, of course you buy the house. What are the chances of that happening again? So you buy the house.
Yeah, no, I guess so. Yeah, fantastic. Okay, well, this brings us to the very last question, which is, what is the funniest movie? Oh, sorry, no, what is the film that made you laugh out loud the most?
Laugh out loud is the crux here.
Yeah, because it's not the funniest, because some movies can be just hugely funny, but sometimes there are internal laughs.
Yes. Flying High, laugh out loud funny. Monty Python and the Holy Grail, laugh out loud funny. I'm going to get emails for this, and I'm going to get a glare from you, but The Party is still laugh out loud funny for me.
God, I thought we could make it through this podcast without you mentioning it.
The film that makes me laugh out loud nonstop, and I'm going to get another roll of the eyes from you here, is Woody Allen's Love and Death, his send up of War and Peace.
I haven't seen it.
It is one of the most hilariously, consistently funny movies throughout. But the one scene that made me snort lemonade through my nose when I was drinking it was the putting on the Ritz scene from Young Frankenstein when Gene Wilder and Peter Boyle. I do put it on the Ritz. I'm just doing that noise then made me giggle. It's one of the funniest. It's arguably the funniest scene I've ever seen in a movie, and that does make me burst out legitimately laughing.
So the movie that I remember laughing the most at while watching it, I was exhausted. Like, I was physically in pain leaving the cinema after having seen this film. It was a movie from, I'm going to say 1999. No, it's got to be later than that. Anyway, it was called South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. There was a scene, and I'm going to use some judicious microphone sort of musing in a moment for reasons of taste. But there's a moment where I believe that it is Cartman's mum who has to explain what a... oh, my God. My God, Simon. As soon as I heard that being discussed on screen, like... I was off like a rocket.
Wow, yes. Very, very funny film. And I was never big on South Park. I mean, I watched and enjoyed it, but it was never a laugh out loud TV show for me, but the movie is very, very funny. Yep. Can't argue with that. Wow. Okay. The films to be buried with. That worked well.
Yeah. I'm just trying to find the year.
What we usually do.
Yeah, no, way better. I don't think we can repeat that.
South Park was 99.
Yeah, it was 99. Well, it must come really closely after the launch of the show then. I thought it'd run for a couple of years, but not at all.
Don't know.
Yeah.
So the films we've been buried with, that was a lot of fun. I had a good time researching that. That took up a good part of my Thursday before we recorded this. I do just want to point out very quickly, we had a lovely email from Geordie Cowan, who wrote back on June 29 when we had that fill-in show for Indiana Jones. Geordie wrote, just a quick note to say that I am loving Deadlock. Oh, this is very
tough. There's always one.
Yeah, I watched the first episode last night. I really liked it too. After the first couple of episodes, I was probably not on board, says Geordie. I found it too abrasive and the storyline was a bit all over the top. I agree that the character played by the New Zealand actress is a bit abrasive. But I think it really started gathering momentum from episodes 3 and 4 and greatly enjoying it now, coupled with so many Aussie actors and the Tassie scenery. We also finally got around to watching Poker Face and going through it very quickly. I do wonder about how sustainable the plot is. Yeah, that's not a valid point. Well, I think it should be fairly sustainable.
I think it's fine. Traveling. It's a story of the week. It's the same as any sort of 1970s Incredible Hulk or Fugitive or...
Yeah.
Although
the caliber of the actors is brilliant. And Natasha Lyonne is a pleasure to view in this role. Glad she got an Emmy nomination. Thank you, Geordie, for your email. Screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. The show didn't get a whole lot of extra Emmy love, did it? Which I was a bit surprised by.
I thought it'd get a bit more. Now, I did actually think that this week we'd talk about the Emmys a fair bit, but also I don't think the Emmys are going to take place this year. So I think it's maybe...
Really? You think it's not going to happen with all the strike action going on?
No. I reckon there's a good chance, because it's not going to happen if the writers are still on strike.
Yep.
And the writing strike. So if people checked out my award-winning newsletter, Always Be Watching, there's been no awards. But my mum says it's good, which is a reward in itself. It was a discussion about how this is the first time that both the Writers and Actors Guilds have been on strike together at the same time since 1960.
Yeah.
Okay, so like it's been some time. And when that happened, the writers were on strike, and I'm just trying to go off the top of my head at the moment. I think the actors' strike lasted about a month and a half, and then they kept the writers going for like another 2 months after that. Now, if you sort of think about that, like the idea that the Emmy Awards could be held in 7 weeks from now, okay, seems pretty fanciful, I think.
Yeah, they don't seem to be any closer to any kind of solution to the problems they're facing. In fact, as we record this, Fran Drescher, the head of the SAG, got up and has apparently delivered a scathing and very vitriolic speech in favour of her guild and...
Fran Drescher had
lines in the sand.
Fran Drescher had to come out swinging because she was about to lose her job as head of as SAG when two nights before the deadline was hit, she was seen in Europe getting selfies with Kardashian.
She went on a holiday.
She went on a holiday.
Scott Morris. She pulled a full Scott Morrison and just took off overseas when times were tough.
Yeah, but then also she was like getting photos of someone who was very well noted recently for crossing picket lines.
Oh boy, Fran. No wonder you really turned it on in your speech. Have a look at the speech if you can. She really does go for it. Mm. Well, that's interesting. And as we record this, the Oppenheimer premiere in London, the actors all left at a certain point when the strike was called. There'll be no more premieres. You make the point in your very entertaining and informative newsletter that the big sequel that's screening here and that's filming here in Australia, what's that called?
Mortal Kombat 2.
Mortal Kombat 2 is shut down production on that. Impacting.
The reason why Mortal Kombat was mentioned is because the new House of the Dragon TV series is still in production because the entire cast and crew fall under UK. Union representation. And there's actually rules within that union that they don't have like an allegiance with the US unions at all. So they operate as an entirely different shop. So the UK guys will keep on working on that. But a number of other international productions, including Gladiator 2, which is currently in the works, they're all shutting down because they have SAG-AFTRA or WGA.
So involvement. What that means is that 12 months from now, you'll either be watching House of Dragon or old repeats of MASH.
I mean, the thing is, like, 3 weeks from now, that might be the case. So broadcast TV has dumped all of their scripted shows, and so now it's just going to be like a whole raft of repeats or just unscripted things, and game shows will become a bigger thing. But, like, even game shows, a lot of the writing there tends to happen with WGA, like, staff or affiliated staff. So, like, Jeopardy, for example, I was reading about this morning, fans of that show are really concerned that while they've been able to see out the end of this current season, because all the questions have already been written, when it comes to September, like, that's, you know, probably not going to go ahead. And the same for, like, the good bulk of a whole bunch of shows. So that's going to be a challenge.
We're probably going to have to find a whole lot more podcasts to steal from in the coming months.
No, we absolutely are, because I'm literally in a position where I'm looking at my newsletter that goes out every day of the week with TV, like, related news, and I can't just write a newsletter about the strike. Like, that's just not going to be that interesting to people, particularly considering that, you know, just slightly over 50% of my readership are Australian-based, where the strike is an overseas issue. Okay, I do have a lot of US readers, so there is, like, stronger relevance there, but even so. So my newsletter is probably going to go to twice a week or something in a week or two, I suspect. But
oh, my God.
We'll see. And bear in mind, I've been running this newsletter since I was working at SBS, so that's like 5 years ago now or something. Pretty much I'd say that in that entire time, I've missed like daily publishing like maybe 3 or 4 times.
You're dedicated to it. You absolutely are.
Yeah.
Yeah. What am I going to do? Go back to watching some of the movies we mentioned today.
Yeah.
So if you have a podcast you'd like us to rip off, write us an email at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. We're like the cuckoo bird of podcasters. We'll just slip into the nest of other podcasters and take their formats. That's what we do.
Yeah. I've got a couple of true crimes I want to discuss, Simon.
Yeah, I bet you do. I know. I've seen your garage. I've seen your meat tendering room. All right.
Okay.
Sign off.
Well, folks, this has been Screen Watching. You can find me on... Actually, we'll skip that line for a moment. Start your day with my free newsletter for as long as it's still daily. It's called Always Be Watching. Find that one at alwaysbewatching.com. It's got the big stories in TV, streaming, and film. And then on Fridays, I've got the Always Be Streaming newsletter, which recounts the big shows that launched that very week. Also, yes, I am still on Twitter, and you can find me at the Dan Barrett. But also, you can find me on Threads at the Dan Barrett.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd crossed over. I launched the Sydney Film Festival, Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival Threads page the other day and got some great response. So that's maybe a thing.
I should probably follow that.
Yeah, probably should. Read my words over at screen-space.net or at ScreenSpace on Facebook. Screen Watching is, of course, all over your socials at Screen Watching Podcast on Facebook, at screen_watching on Twitter, the Screen Watching YouTube channel. I put a few new trailers up there this week. The new trailer for Ahsoka. Is that how you say it? The new Disney Plus thing, Ahsoka?
Yeah, Ahsoka.
Mario Dawson. Yeah. And do email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. Like, follow, share from all your favorite platforms. Let's shout out to Brett Goldstein. Thank you very much for letting us pilfer your podcast format. We had a lot of fun doing our little version of it. Go to wherever you listen to podcasts and do check out Films to Be Buried with Brett Goldstein. It's a lot of fun.
Indeed. We'll be back next week. We've got some stuff we'll review, probably, I guess. I guess you'll talk about Barbie and Oppenheimer, right?
Yeah, I got a big week next week. Barbie Monday night, Oppenheimer Tuesday night, a new Scandi horror film called Sisu, which has had a bit of a buzz around the world. That's on Wednesday night. So
I have
week back at the movies.
I have zero interest in Barbie, even less interest in Oppenheimer, but I'm all in on Sisu.
What?
No, I am.
Boy, these are big deals. I know you've got a thing about Barbie. You don't like the whole body image thing, which I think is going to come up in our review because that also plays across Superman and male representation of the superhero thing. So that'll become a thing.
It's slightly different, but...
Not now, but we'll take it up next week. That's selling the sizzle for next week's podcast. But why are you down on Oppenheimer? You're not a Nolan fan or you're not an Oppenheimer fan?
Oh, I think that Nolan, you know, some of his films are amongst my favorite. Others I find just really boring and turgid. But there's just nothing about the Oppenheimer story that's being sold to me through the marketing that makes me think I'm going to be interested in watching it. It just seems like a really dull trip.
The nuclear age? Wow.
No, no.
All right. Simon.
No, no, Simon. We're selling me on the movie and not on what the guy did, which is... Okay. Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, what he did isn't actually really, you know, visually that exciting. It's what other people did with his work that was exciting, visually.
Yeah, I'm keen to see why it holds such a pull for Nolan and how it plays into his...
And- Look, Simon, I'm gonna see Oppenheimer. I'll probably see Barbie, but ultimately I'm just not excited about either. But Sisu looks effing great, and I'm very excited about it. Cool. Yeah. All
right. So that's what I'll be talking about next week.
Mm. But anyway, Simon, let's get out of here.
Okay, bye-bye.
How's it been an hour and a half?
Oh, it's been nuts, but I've loved every minute of it.
Yeah, I've liked most of them. See ya.